Why do global multinational companies like Unilever, Google, Mahindra & Mahindra set sustainability goals? It is because they believe they can do better with less. Hello and welcome to the Mission Shunya podcast. I am Girish Shivakumar. As I continue to explore this transition to a zero carbon economy, it is hard to miss the work done by the global multinational companies. Global multinational companies are increasingly setting sustainability targets, be it reducing the water use or procuring energy from renewable sources. Companies are setting targets and achieving them. On this special episode, I have a conversation with Professor Jaideep Prabhu. Jaideep Prabhu is the Jawaharlal Nehru Professor for Indian Business and Enterprise at the Judge Business School in University of Cambridge. Professor Prabhu first co-authored the book Jugaad Innovation in 2012. Jugaad Innovation looked at how Indian companies are adopting frugal practices and creating value. The book was a bestseller, and subsequently, a few years down the line, Professor Prabhu co-authored another book, Frugal Innovation, which looked at companies in the Western world and how they are adopting frugal practices. In his recent book, Do Better With Less, Professor Prabhu looks at the emergence of the circular economy, the maker movement, and how companies are using these principles to create value to their consumers. So without further ado, here is a conversation that we had. Hello, Professor Prabhu. Glad to have you on the Mission Shunya podcast.
Thank you, Girish. It's my pleasure to join you today.
Yeah, first, a big congratulations on yet another great book. Following up on something like Jugaad Innovation must be really an interesting challenge for you to undertake. So how did Do Better With Less come about?
So it actually started with Jugaad Innovation because, as you may know, that book was very much about how people in countries like India do better with less, how they are able to overcome the resource constraints they face to develop products and services that can be highly affordable and reach very large numbers of people. So, you know, we wrote the Jugaad Innovation book and published it in 2012. It was very much about how companies from the West going to countries like India could learn from their Indian and African and other counterparts. But after that book came out in 2012, we realized there was a lot of interest in frugal innovation in the West for the West. So we started to look at that, and we realized that there were some similarities, but also some differences between the developed world and the developing world. And that's when we wrote a follow-up book called Frugal Innovation, which was really about the West. And that book came out in 2015. And then we realized that, you know, in many ways, India has caught up with the West. It's probably in some cases even leapfrogging. And so we published this most recent book, Do Better With Less, which has elements of Jugaad in it, elements of frugal innovation, and elements of what India is now doing in the space of frugal innovation.
The first thing that catches one's attention in the book is the title, Do Better With Less, Frugal Innovation for Sustainable Growth. You have certain key themes in the book. Would you want to share why? How did you pick those key themes, or how did they come about? I'm sure they came about by looking at the similarities, as you mentioned, from all those case studies that you've seen.
Yeah, so actually, you know, after the Jugaad book came out and when we started looking at frugal innovation in the West for the West, one of the things we noticed was the rise of what we call prosumers. So these are not passive consumers. They're not just passive recipients of products and services from companies. They're much more actively involved in the economic process. And they are driving three movements we think underpin the frugal economy around the world. And these are the sharing economy, which is where you and I can now trade spare assets with each other on some digital platform, examples being Airbnb, Uber, etc. The second pillar is what we call the maker movement, where now small teams of people, sometimes even my own students, are able to do things that only large companies or the government could do 10 or 20 years ago. And this is not only in software, this is also increasingly in hardware, using digital manufacturing tools, cheap computers, sensors, etc. And finally, the third pillar is what we call the circular economy. And this is where companies and also people are no longer just, you know, taking virgin resources from nature, making products with them, selling them, and then people use them and just dump the product back in nature. Instead, people are reducing, reusing, and recycling. So we build the book essentially around these key movements and then look at what companies around the world are doing in the space of sharing or making or circular economy. And we look at some principles that we think are guiding them in doing better with less.
So the sharing economy, the maker movement, and the circular economy are very key themes. And you bring about like six principles on how companies are going about doing this. In terms of the companies that you have profiled, you have looked at some global companies who have ambitious targets. And you have interacted with most of the companies as part of various case studies you have undertaken. So what is the general feeling that you get when you talk to them? And what is the feeling now compared to like around 2010, 2012?
Yeah, so, you know, what is interesting is that many companies, particularly large companies that have a big environmental footprint, because, for instance, they are involved with sourcing food, which has a huge footprint in terms of water and energy, just in growing the food, but then also in the logistics, moving food around and then storing it, and then, of course, distributing it to retailers and so on. You see that a lot of these big companies now realize that it's in their own business interests to reduce their footprint, to reduce the amount of virgin resources they're using, whether it's timber or water or oil or energy more generally. They also realize that, let's say, take a company like IKEA. They know that, their business model depends on them being able to access, timber, not just today when there's already a lot of pressure on resources, but in 10 and 30 years' time when there'll be even more pressure. So, they are looking to reduce their footprint, reduce their use of energy and of scarce resources, and also to be able to reuse their resources as far as possible. So I mentioned IKEA. One of the things IKEA is doing is now moving towards a model where they don't just sell you furniture, and this is particularly B2B where they're selling office furniture, but they actually rent you the furniture. And that way they keep a control over the physical assets, the materials, which they can then recover and reuse, recycle. We cover another similar company in the book called Tarkett, which is a French flooring company. They make flooring solutions for offices and also for sports facilities and so on. They have this very ambitious target of becoming a fully circular enterprise by 2020. They realize that isn't just a technical challenge, but also a business challenge. They have to, again, move their customer from a kind of world where they would buy, in a transactional way, they would buy flooring, to a world where they will sign a contract, a service contract with Tarkett, and Tarkett will, over a five-year period, provide them a service of flooring for their offices. And what Tarkett will do is that if, for instance, they're putting carpets down, they'll use a modular design, so they can only replace, they will only need to replace those bits of the carpet that have been worn out, and then they will recycle those bits of the carpet and replace them. So, you see this with companies like Unilever that again have this very ambitious target of doubling their sales, but halving their footprint. They are doing this across the whole company. And including with their partners, so they work with farmers to ensure that farmers are adopting sustainable farming practices. They work in their whole supply chain to make sure that the logistics are as efficient as possible. They've redesigned their factories and their offices to make them not only energy neutral, but actually net positive. They generate energy, for instance, with solar panels. They also have rethought their packaging. So in many cases, they have made, for instance, deodorants in more compressed containers, which requires lower use of aluminium without, of course, compromising on performance for the customer. So you see lots of large companies now moving towards the circular economy.
Those are really wonderful examples. And for anyone who's listening to this for the first time, I would definitely recommend to read the book in detail where you discuss all these cases in detail. The one particular case on similar line that kind of interests me more is the story of Levi's. So of their jeans that uses less water and how they kind of ask the other jean manufacturers to adopt the similar practices. So that is another interesting story that you write in the book. The other key message that clearly you write and mention is how the companies now look up to all these practices as a solution that is cheap is not something that is acceptable to anyone in the developing world. They want quality and they are willing to pay the price for the quality product. That is something that you bring out in the book as well. Companies have figured this out in different markets in different ways.
Yeah, so, you know, we have learned this lesson both the hard way and, the easy way. The hard way being through mistakes. So, you know, many people point out that the Nano was not a success despite applying many principles of frugal innovation. So they did get some things right. They had this vision of a market for people who currently have two-wheelers and who would like a four-wheeler. They worked backwards from the price that they thought would be needed to reach that market. They did a lot of innovation. They even had patents. They came up with a car which I think technically is a great car. It actually provides a great value for money for the price that it sold. But unfortunately, they made some mistakes, and one of the big mistakes was that it was positioned as the world's cheapest car. They got a lot of publicity for it, but that was the wrong sort of publicity. Because you really want, as you pointed out, the car has to be aspirational. People want an affordable car, but they don't want the cheapest car. They want a car that is cool, that has space, that's easy to drive, and so on. So, you know, we've learned from examples like the Nano that you can get a lot of it right, but you also need to think about the positioning. And, you know, another example is Renault, which actually didn't make those mistakes. They did everything, in a sense, right when they went into Eastern Europe. And that's why we begin the book with that story of Renault going into Eastern Europe in the 90s and realizing in countries like Romania, there were Soviet-era cars that were highly affordable that would sell for, you know, equivalent of 5,000 or 6,000 euros. But, of course, the quality was poor. And so they combined French expertise in engineering with the Romanian engineer's ability to do things frugally and developed a line of cars called the Dacia line, which was initially meant only for Eastern Europe and did very well in Eastern Europe, but in a few years started to do extremely well in Western Europe as well. And now those cars account for something like 40% of Renault's revenue. So, you know, I think of point is absolutely well taken. Frugal innovation isn't just about something that's cheaper and of lower quality. It is something that's cheaper and is appropriate to the needs of the target sector.
So in the first half of the interview, we spoke about global companies, the common themes and their best practices. But as Professor Prabhu references a study, India, by leveraging the principles of circular economy, could reap economic benefits to the tune of around $600 billion and could cut the greenhouse gas emissions by around 44% by 2050. Another study also claims that 50% of the progress towards the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals would come from India. So, the second half of the interview, the focus is on India and the best practices of companies operating in India. The point about Nano is an interesting point that you bring about, and how in the same market, for example, the Renault's similar car in Indian market is doing well in recent years. So that's an interesting story. The story of Nano interest also leads me to the India specific query that I had. So you clearly mentioned the concepts of sharing economy, the circular economy is very well imbibed in the Indian culture, and India should probably take a leadership position in frugal innovation. Or you mentioned the other way around, saying India could lose its position in frugal innovation considering what the companies in the West are doing. Like Renault story is one story that you write. What's your feel about how the companies in India are performing in this space?
Yeah, you know, so that's partly what is driving us to, what drove us to write this book, which is that, in a way, India has some inherent advantages, you could say, in terms of being a world leader in frugal innovation. In fact, when we wrote the Jugaad book, India was in some ways associated globally with this notion of doing more with less, doing better with less. So we had some very outstanding successes in many different parts or different sectors, from financial services to healthcare to education and also mobility and so on. As I said, subsequent to writing the Jugaad book, frugal innovation has taken off in other parts of the world. In the West, you have these very dramatic developments around sharing economy, circular economy, maker movement, etc. But so the pressure, in a sense, is now on India to up its own game, to be able to build on its traditional strengths, its traditional mindset, its traditional abilities in frugal innovation, but also leverage some of the more recent tools that people in the West have been leveraging to do frugal innovation. So tools that have to do with software and computing, cheaper computing, cloud computing, but also tools that are to do with making physical objects, you know, particularly through digital manufacturing, 3D printers, laser cutters, these kinds of tools. But also, obviously, the internet, which enables you not only to make prototypes, whether software or hardware, but also to potentially raise money through crowdfunding, to advertise and promote in a very frugal way through social media, and to distribute your products, again, frugally to websites like Amazon and so on. So we felt, and therefore wrote this book, Do Better With Less, that India needs to recapture its global brand, shall we say, global reputation for being a leader in frugal innovation, and have some opportunities here, not only to leapfrog, but really to trailblaze, to create some really new ways of doing better with less. And we cover in the book examples of Indian companies, both large and small, that are doing exactly that.
Yes, we will get to the Indian companies that you cover in the book. But before that, you also have like interesting cases of global companies who entered India in the last couple of decades, but came up with a different mindset of a global mindset of development, but then had to figure out ways to make things better. One classic example that you have spoken about in various forums and also you have mentioned in this book is the case of Siemens. Siemens coming to India and developing devices that had to be in the Indian market. Would you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so, you know, medical devices is a very interesting area. And in general, I suppose, even industrial goods. And there you have several Western companies that, starting in the 90s already, began to set up large R&D centers in places like Bangalore, for example. So I'll get to Siemens, but probably GE was there first. You know, there's a very big Jack Welch Technology Center in Bangalore, $100 million facility, started off employing something like 3,000 engineers and scientists. Now they're about 4,500. It's the largest R&D center that GE has in the world, and it's pretty integrated on the same campus. You have people looking at solutions in health and medical devices and energy and so on. And initially, you're right, they came there to really
in a way, exploit relatively low-cost, high-quality Indian engineers and scientists to leverage their human capital to work on problems that were driven out of headquarters, really rich world problems. But then they realized there were many opportunities they were missing in the Indian market. For instance, medical devices for doctors who will go from the city to the countryside on day trips and will need a portable ECG device. So they then developed these solutions, these portable ECG devices, basically copying their Indian Jugaad competitors, you know, using the Jugaad approach of taking off-the-shelf components and cutting and pasting them and applying a quality control standard. So, for instance, for the ECG machine, they needed a printer, and they said, okay, bus ticket printer, you can use those components. You need a keypad, you can use telephone keypad. So that product came out faster, better, cheaper. It did very well in India. They produced a similar one for China. They did very well, and then they started to sell in the West after they got FDA approval. So that was just one example. They've gone on to now develop a whole suite of not only medical devices, but all kinds of other solutions in this way. So Siemens has also done something similar. Siemens has a very large R&D center in Bangalore. They've also done frugal medical devices. So for instance, you know, to check the status of the fetal heart when the mother's pregnant, you typically in the West will use ultrasound, which is very expensive and requires a technician to manage and operate. Siemens has developed a device that essentially uses microphone technology to do the same thing. It's much cheaper and much less complex. And they've gone on to actually develop a whole suite of products. They call smart products, SMART, which stands for simple, maintenance friendly, affordable, reliable, and timely to market. And these are all kinds of industrial devices and products which initially they developed for emerging markets, but now they find a global marketplace for them.
Yeah, big companies setting up in operations and pioneering them have been a success story in recent years, as you rightly say. The other key message that you bring out in the book is how big companies, global corporations, have adopted sustainability practices and think about sustainability in a bigger picture rather than the earlier notion of sustainability just being part of the CSR activities. How did this transition come about in the companies?
Yeah, great question. So first of all, as I said, there was a gradual realization that sustainability isn't just a nice thing to do because, you know, some people care about the environment and they're worried that, you know, the environment is degraded and leading to climate change. They really started to make it a central part of their strategy when they realized their own business may not be around in 10 or 20 years unless they are environmentally sustainable. And then they also realized that their businesses would not be around in 10 or 20 years if they weren't also in some way socially sustainable. If, for instance, they're sourcing from farmers and those farmers cannot make a livelihood, if their fields, if their practices are not sustainable, and then their fields will not have productive yields, you know, in 10 years, then the business itself will not function. It will not be able to be viable or sustainable. So you've seen this progression where it was a nice to have to where it's essential. And you know, this is where the competitive kind of forces also work. So if a Nestle is doing it, then a Danone will do it, and a Unilever will do it, and a P&G will do it. Then if it's working in food, then people in energy will do it, and people in telecom will do it, and so on and so forth. So you see this kind of movement, a kind of, you could say, a virtuous circle that is developing in the sustainability realm. What is actually even more interesting, which we cover in the book, is that these companies also realize that their footprint isn't just in their operations. A large part of the footprint they're creating also happens when we, the consumer, use their products in our home. So, for instance, you know, we might boil a whole kettle of water to make just one cup of tea. or we might take a 10-minute shower when we could take 5-minute showers. And so these large companies now are thinking of ways to nudge consumers into being more responsible in the home. You gave the example of Levi's. So Levi's has done a lot in its own factory to reduce its use of water. So they had a line of jeans which they called Wasteless, where a large part of the jeans were from recycled plastic bottles. They also had another line called Waterless, where they figured out a way to reduce the amount of water needed to make the jeans by something like 90%. But if you take the Waterless line, they realize that, okay, they can reduce the use of water in the jeans, but what about us when we buy the jeans and keep washing them all the time? That's a lot of use of water energy. So then they started to try and nudge their users into washing the jeans less often.
I totally agree on the two main points that you mentioned about competition among the big corporates to beat the other in terms of who is more sustainable or who aligns more with the sustainable development goals and those targets. I've seen similar exercise in India where you talk about the prosumers in the book. A similar kind of experience is here in India where large companies put solar power plants on their roofs and kind of claim to have like reduced their bills by 30%. And that has created a movement and many companies are coming forward to put solar on the roofs. A similar case is with nudge again. Nudge on the consumer end. You bring about the story of thermostats and how people are turning more energy efficient, being more conscious about what they are using and how well they are maintaining their systems, etc. On a final note, you portray a lot of case studies and stories of many companies, many Indian companies after each principle that you lay out in the book. All the case stories are really interesting. I would personally pick up the story of Shailaja Rangarajan. Would you like to tell the listeners from your interaction with her on how she's pioneering the circular economy through her work by upcycling material?
Yeah, so, in the book, for each of the six principles that you said, we have a case of an Indian entrepreneur or company that exemplifies that particular principle. So there are six of these, and they are written as interviews. And one of them is this Shailaja Rangarajan, who founded and runs this company called Reimagine. So basically, Reimagine. And it's an upcycling company. So it's a company that doesn't just do recycling of used fabrics and textiles and clothes and Tetra Paks and e-waste and so on. She doesn't just do recycling, she does upcycling. That is, in the process of reusing them, you actually create more value. And so what Reimagine does is it sources these kinds of waste materials. And then she works with people in, often women in villages, people from tribal areas and so on even, who have these wonderful traditional skills. They're artisans, they know how to stitch and weave and embroider and so on. And they can make things like bags and household furnishings, which then Shailaja can sell in cities or even export. Shailaja has this wonderful business that she created in Bangalore, and which is now operating in Bangalore and Kolkata, and as I said, also works with people in tribal areas in Odisha. What's interesting is that, in a way, she's combining those three pillars I mentioned. Obviously, she's using the circular economy principles of reduce, reuse, and recycle. But there is also a component of her being a maker or working with makers, particularly traditional makers and artisans. But also, her model is a kind of sharing economy model, if you think about it, because it's sort of like a two-sided market on a digital platform. So on the one side, she has people who are the makers, who make these upcycled products. And on the other side, the market is people like you and me who are in metropolitan areas who would like to buy these products and use them in our homes and so on. So she's an excellent example. I'm glad you chose her. because in many ways he exemplifies not only the circular economy upcycling principles, but also the principles of sharing economy and making it.
Yes, I chose her because she exemplifies all the principles that you mentioned, as you rightly said. But I would definitely recommend the listeners to check the other case studies, and they are really interesting case studies. Professor Prabhu, thank you very much for taking time and sharing your thoughts and sharing more about the book and how you conceptualize the book from your interactions with the various companies. So thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Girish. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate you reaching out. And I hope your listeners like this podcast and read the book and find it interesting.
So with that, it's a wrap on the interview. In short, global companies are fighting climate change by building circular value chains that encourage sharing, recycling, and reuse of resources, which is a big step towards Mission Chunya. I would definitely recommend you to read the book Do Better With Less. If you are in Bangalore, I can give you a copy of the book. So drop me an email, missionchunya@gmail.com, or reach out to me on social media platforms. Of course, you should also check out the other best-selling books, Jugaad Innovation and Frugal Innovation. Now on to this week's action step towards Mission Chunya. Considering this special episode is released during the week of World Environment Day, the biggest action that you can take is help spread the word about Mission Chunya. Get more people involved in this movement. You can share the podcast to a friend or colleague this week. The podcast is available on all major platforms, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google's Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, and so on. If you have been listening to this podcast for quite some time and had a feedback to give, write a review and give a rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps in the podcast visibility so that more people get to know about it. You can also write me an email, missionchunya@gmail.com. So until next time when we meet on the podcast, we can keep the conversations going on social media. You can follow Mission Chunya on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. The handle is @missionchunya. So until next time, signing off, this is Mission Chunya, towards a zero carbon economy.